The possibility of federal troops in Chicago, uncertain public transit funding, and the ongoing fight over gerrymandering are just three of the issues swirling around state and local leaders. I'm WBBM Noon Business Hour host Rob Hart. We talk about public safety, budgets, and how we elect our representatives with David Greising, president and CEO of the Better Government Association, on this weekend's edition of At Issue. David Greising, president and CEO of the Better Government Association in Chicago. Thank you for joining us on At Issue in person today. Consider this an extended edition of Watchdog Wednesday or Follow-Up Friday. So thank you for joining us today.
Nothing like being in person with you, Rob. So glad to be here. Thank you.
Because normally you're on the phone here, there, and everywhere. The big story this week, of course, is the National Guard, the possibility of the National Guard being deployed in Chicago in some form or fashion. And the last time this happened was during the George Floyd protests in 2020. I still have the letter from the company, the parent company of this radio station, in my car telling me that, informing anybody who asked, that I was an essential communication worker on official business, and I could present that to anybody who was guarding the expressway entrances into downtown Chicago. And then before that, it was 1968, called in twice, first for the riots following the assassination of Martin Luther King in April of that year, and then the Democratic National Convention in August. Governor Pritzker, Mayor Johnson, Attorney General Raul all say they will use every legal method to stop it or scale it back. Now, David, what are some of the legal issues at play, and what can local officials do to stop this?
Well, this is a classic states' rights versus federal government issue, and we're hearing a lot of rhetoric from the elected officials. I don't know how many were behind Governor Pritzker the other day at this big press program he held, not to mention fellow electeds like Dick Durbin and Tammy Duckworth, et cetera. One of the reasons I think they're making such a demonstration is that, frankly, the legal authority to prevent the federalized National Guard troops is pretty weak. And the president can demand that the Guard be active. Whether a governor of a state can stop that, if in fact it happens, is still up for grabs. We've seen at Washington, D.C., which is a special case, that President Trump has started to exercise his authority. At the state and local level, it's a completely different question. The lawyers will be very busy on this. One of the reasons that President Trump so far has backed away is that I think his lawyers are probably whispering in his ear saying, "Mr. President, you got to be careful on this one, because it really could initiate a constitutional crisis."
Washington, D.C., of course, is a federal district, so there are different jurisdictional issues involved in calling in the National Guard in the nation's capital. There was the Guard was called in Los Angeles in the wake of demonstrations against immigration enforcement actions in that city. But once again, the question, you know, what is the legal authority and the legal reason to call in the National Guard? And the one thing that occurred to me that kind of popped into my head when this policy was reported over the weekend by the Washington Post is that local lawmakers have proposed this idea before. During a especially violent stretch in 2010, several local lawmakers called on then Governor Quinn and Mayor Daley to call in the National Guard to end violent crime. So that the road to this particular moment could have been paved by local politicians looking for earned media, knowing that it would never happen, but now it has happened, or it could potentially happen. And your thoughts on maybe people throwing around ideas that were, you know, pretty casually and in a cavalier fashion, never anticipating someone to follow through, and now someone could potentially follow through, and here we are.
Well, someone being the President of the United States who's making the case that this is an emergency because crime is so high, when in fact the facts don't support that. We've seen actually a decrease in crime. Crime in Chicago has declined by 13% so far this year. Murders have declined by 51% since 2021, as was the case in Washington when President Trump first declared an emergency there. The case in Chicago is hard to make. The thing is, the president can make this declaration, and then the lawyers have to run off to court and hope they find a judge who will put a stop to whatever it is that the president chooses to do. The powers of the local authorities up against the power of the president of the United States, usually the president wins in that one. Eventually, the courts can catch up with him, as we've seen happen time and time again during the Trump administration. But on the ground, we could have National Guard troops there until the courts sort it up. We'll sort it out. We'll find out over time what happens.
Now you are correct. Violent crime has dropped considerably, even since last year. Homicides down 31% compared to this time in 2024. Robbery down 33%. Burglary down 2%, criminal sexual assault down 3% from this time last year. And as you pointed out, way down from elevated numbers in 2020 and 2021. You know, the numbers are the numbers. That is the trend. But the critics would say, well, okay, well, what about the nightclub? What about something? What about shootings that happen any weekend in Chicago? What about my general feeling of unease? And they believe this is an idea whose time has come. So what would this look like practically? How can the National Guard enforce law in Chicago?
Well, you're pointing to something very important, is the politics of this, in which people living in cities or people who visit big cities are nervous these days. In addition to what you've just mentioned, Rob, we've had these teen takeovers that have led to violence in a couple of different cases. We've seen smash and grab tactics that, you know, groups of thieves use in order to go in and steal tens and hundreds of thousands worth of merchandise from stores in Streeterville or on the Magnificent Mile. So the perception that people who actually come to cities have of violent crime or property crime being different and more scary than it was in the past, that's absolutely legitimate. And I think that President Trump sees that and is seizing this opportunity to make the case, no matter what the overriding statistics might say. The question that Mayor Johnson put to the president at this big press event the other day was an important one, which is, where is the federal money to help us fight the crime? We can't just send in the troops whenever there's a problem. Where's the federal money, Mr. President? And that's a very important question, because the Chicago Police Department has made some progress in complying with a consent decree, better progress lately than in the initial years of this consent decree. They're under leadership in Superintendent Larry Snelling. That seems pretty effective. What do National Guard troops really know about policing on the streets? There's been a lot of commentary over the last few days, and I think it's accurate, that National Guard troops are not trained to be cops on the beat. There are safety issues with regard to these people. If they are armed, as they have been now in Washington in some instances, if they are armed, are they really equipped to handle the kind of challenges that a cop on the beat, cop on the street faces? No, they're not, and bad things can happen as a result of something like this.
And cynics would point out, and they said this is the case in Washington, that the National Guard was on the National Mall. They were in all of the tourist spots in D.C. outside of Union Station. They were not deployed where actual violent crime was taking place. And if you end up in a situation where you have the National Guard deployed on Michigan Avenue or in Millennium Park or in Lincoln Park, what can they do to stop the main drivers of violence in the city, which is gang violence, which is violence between people who know each other, social media-driven beefs that turn violent in the neighborhoods? How can a National Guard deployment address those issues?
Well, this goes back to what Mayor Johnson said, which is there are bigger issues here than just sending the National Guard. That's not a real fix for the problem that the president claims to be addressing. It has the feel of something that is being planned or done in the case of Washington for show. It looks good on TV if you're predisposed toward having armed guards in fatigues walking the streets of our big cities, but it is not the kind of structural approach to addressing violence that would really actually do some good.
But the show of force, it works on a lot of people. They make for compelling social media videos. And how can a local government address local problems in the face of a federal government and also a social media algorithm that rewards those displays of power?
Well, trying to fight social media algorithms is beyond the scope of what anybody can do these days, other than trying to crack down on the internet platforms. But cooperation between our state and federal and local governments would be a good thing. Obviously, that's not happening these days. President Trump has said again and again that the crime happens in these Democrat-run cities. He's definitely pitting the cities against the rest of the country, and he's doing it for political effect, given that so many of the major cities are headed up by Democrats. In the case of Illinois, as in California, he's got also a very outspoken Democratic governor. To think that these groups, the president, the governor, and the mayor, would get together and actually roll up their sleeves and try to address the underlying problems is probably too much for us to hope for. But one would wish that that's what our elected officials would do, since we, the people, have sent them into their jobs.
And there have been examples of successful state, local, and federal partnerships to end certain categories of crime. The first thing that comes to my mind is the carjacking task force, which has been very successful.
Right. And a lot of us who follow these things were skeptical that the feds would really be able to add much to that. But the feds do have a lot of information that at least the old FBI, as we knew it, had a lot of information about what are the root causes of crime, who are committing these crimes. They surveil and follow people at a level that even CPD and certainly state police don't have access to that kind of information. So if these all can coordinate, we can have more effective crime fighting, as you pointed out. What we're not seeing is that effort to cooperate and coordinate with regard to crimes that really are affecting the quality of life in our big cities, including in Chicago.
You touched on the consent decree and also the efforts made not only by Superintendent Larry Snelling, but Eileen O'Neill Burke, the new Cook County State's Attorney. There has been significant progress in fighting violent crime in the city. Before we talk about the efforts to meet the consent decree, talk about what has been done to result in these double-digit drops in violent crime.
Well, first of all, we're seeing a national trend. What happened in 2020 and 2021 was an anomaly. Those were spikes that were related to both the pandemic and responses to the pandemic that tended to lead toward more violent outbursts on the part of a lot of people, as well as the aftermath of the George Floyd murder up in Minneapolis and the what that led to, not only in terms of the immediate demonstrations, but in terms of trust in police. And trust in police is a big factor in effective policing. If people in the communities don't trust their police, they don't talk to their police, they don't tell them who's committing the crimes, they don't serve as witnesses if the police are successful in arresting people, there's a downward spiral of toward ineffectiveness that happens when trust breaks down. And one of the reasons this consent decree was necessary was because of the history of illegal and rogue policing in the police force of Chicago, a lot of it racially motivated. And so the consent decree is meant to address that. We're starting, after a very, very slow start, we're starting to see some progress. The other thing you need is leadership at the top that really cares and wants to address these problems. Leadership at the mayor's office that's going to fund the kind of improvements that need to happen. It's evident that Larry Snelling, as police chief, is committed to this. He's in enhanced training. He's in enhanced more systematic responses to some of the issues that have been raised with regard to rogue policing. Mayor Johnson is not very fully funding the staffing that it takes to really transform the culture of the police department. In fact, he initially had such significant cuts that the Attorney General of the state spoke out to say, "We need, you know, your police department needs more than it's getting." Mayor Johnson, in response to that and other inputs, has increased some of the funding in this Office of Constitutional Policing and some of the related tasks. But we probably need more support in those areas in order to really change the culture of the Chicago Police Department.
You're listening to Ad Issue on WBBM News Radio. I'm Noon Business Hour host Rob Hart. We're talking with David Greising, President and CEO of the Better Government Association in Chicago. Speaking of funding, Let's talk about the fiscal cliff at the RTA. All three of the transit agencies will run out of that COVID era funding at different times next year. The RTA moved some money around last week from PACE and from METRA to delay CTA budget cuts by a couple of weeks next year. But all three of the transit agencies are looking at substantial service cuts without more money from Springfield. Now, if we were having this conversation 60 years ago, this is an easy fix because you can listen to the tapes in the Lyndon Johnson Library. Mayor Daley, Richard J. Daley, would just call Lyndon Johnson and ask for more money, and that money would be on the way. But LBJ isn't walking through that door. So is a funding fix possible?
Well, and also the mayor of the city of Chicago doesn't quite have the clout either in Springfield or in Washington, D.C., in order to get this kind of thing done. As you noted, the service agencies are facing a $770-some million fiscal cliff. On top of that, it's said that they need between $1 billion and $1.5 billion a year in order to really fix the structural problems that that the system faces. We've seen a move toward a consolidated transit agency, the Northern Illinois Transit Agency, which would replace the Regional Transportation Authority, which has been proven ineffective in part possibly because of the role that the individuals running those organizations face, but really structurally, RTA has not been set up to be successful. We came close to seeing a major structural reform of the transit agencies, the CTA, Metra, and PACE, along with the RTA in the spring legislative session. That fell apart when it developed that some of the ideas thrown out there were not very realistic, and there was a lot of pushback. So during the course of the summer, there's been continued discussion among some of the key legislative leaders and key stakeholders with an eye toward getting this done. There was some talk about a special legislative session, which has not happened because those talks did not get close enough to having a true resolution. So now it's hoped that sometime in the fall veto session, there will be a plan put forward that actually can get the support. Whatever plan it is going to end up, as always, pitting people in the suburbs against people in the city, pitting the stakeholders in the Chicago Transit Authority against, say, Metro and PACE stakeholders, et cetera. It's very, very complicated. But some of the ideas that have been thrown out there are still somewhat live. They include a 10% tax on rideshare, 50-cent tollway surcharge up to $1 a day, possibly taking a share of property transfers, possibly a fare increase. That could end up solving the $771 million problem. I don't think anybody's talking about anything seriously these days that gets to the more significant structural spending that needs to happen in order to bring this system up to date, allow it to serve the needs of the community, all the communities in question, and make it structurally sound on a longer-term basis.
I think people don't understand or don't realize, just because it's been around for so long, the RTA is 50 years old. And even then, it was a patchwork of policy fixes for what was ailing public transit at the time in 1974. I mean, the impetus for the RTA was a number of suburbs along bankrupt commuter railroads pooling their resources to buy new equipment because right. And you'll see this too if you ride the BNSF. You will see commuter coaches labeled for the West Suburban Mass Transit District, and that was a forerunner of the RTA. And that you might remember when all the suburbs had different bus services that were right. all consolidated under PACE, and then of course the CTA was and is the behemoth of the transit agencies. And they've tried to live together, and they've had to live with less. I mean, there was that big funding crisis in the early 80s that required Governor Thompson going to Washington to get more money. So we've been here before.
Right.
But they've managed to just keep the patchwork together and really trying to put together a 21st century public transit framework for the Chicago area could be a job that's beyond any elected official.
Well, it could be, Robert. I mean, you accurately point out that the rolling stock, as they call it, the train cars, are decades old. They've patched them together with baling wire and bubble gum and make them still work. They put in new seats every once in a while, so it feels a little bit newer. But we're nowhere close to having anything like a modern transit system in this city or the northern metropolitan area. And that needs to happen, but the money just, there's no sign anywhere of that kind of money being in sight. The bigger question is how to fix, as you pointed out, there have been some short-term fixes to try to prevent a service cut or a reduction or elimination on a temporary basis of service. But they're still threatening that at the RTA level that could happen if we don't get some help from Springfield in this fall session.
Illinois found itself at the center of the debate over gerrymandering this month, and that's the practice of drawing congressional and legislative districts to maximize partisan advantage. Texas wanted to redraw their congressional maps to max out the number of Republicans who can be elected to the House in next year's elections. Texas Democrats fled to Illinois at the request of Governor Pritzker to deny a quorum. They've done this before.
Right.
They went to Oklahoma in 2003 to hold off redistricting on the legislative level, and they attracted national attention to their cause. I mean, Willie Nelson sent them red bandanas and his whiskey as a show of support. But Illinois does not have clean hands in this particular fight. The congressional map is gerrymandered for Democrats. The legislative map is gerrymandered for a supermajority. But it seems like you're going to have a gerrymandering arms race. Obviously, Governor Pritzker is open to the idea of doing a mid-decade redistricting. California Governor Gavin Newsom has really burnished his national profile by promising to max out the number of Democrats in that state. And this seems like a fight that's not going to end until someone comes in from above and imposes a truce.
Well, I don't know who that magical person might be, because the two parties, it's always a case where the party in power doesn't want to allow us to get to any real fair map, and the party out of power is shaking their hands at the universe, complaining about it. We had a moment of truth this week in the sense that the question about the gerrymandering, badly gerrymandered Illinois legislative maps came up. Bill Daley, the son of the former mayor, Richard Daley, brother of
former White House chief of staff, Bill Daley.
Yeah, absolutely. And Ray LaHood, also part of a Republican downstate, a very prominent Republican family, got together and are pushing for fixing the gerrymandering of the state legislative maps in Illinois. They think they need to raise about $4 million in order to get the signatures on the ballots that they need in order to pass a constitutional amendment. This is happening even as Governor Pritzker prepares to gerrymander the congressional maps in order to fight what's happening in Texas. Governor Pritzker has said this local effort, this Illinois-only effort, he didn't comment on it so much other than to say he thinks it ought to be done on a national basis. That's really a way of just punting on the issue. Governor Pritzker ran as an anti-gerrymandering candidate when one of the worst gerrymandered maps in the nation was put in front of him. He signed it. He benefits from the fact that he's got two huge supermajorities, one in the House and one in the Senate, and in the state house I'm talking about here. And he seems uninclined to do what really would be the right thing to do: let the people vote in maps that actually represent their interests, and instead is calling for a national solution. That's really just a delay tactic on the part of this governor and other governors across the country who say, let's do this on a national basis. There's no serious movement toward fixing state gerrymandering on a national basis, especially in the midst of this battle over the congressional maps, which is going to play out over the next several weeks and months.
Yeah, but from a better government standpoint, I mean, we're in a situation now where when it comes to gerrymandering, whether it's in a state like Illinois, which has large Democratic majorities, or in other states where there are large Republican majorities, once you have that power, it seems like lawmakers relish the opportunity to pick the electorate as opposed to the other way around, which is the way it works.
Right.
And it seems like everything that frustrates you about politics, and I say this as the royal you, everything that frustrates people about politics stems from the fact that a lot of politicians know that they have these maps that make them unaccountable, and they act accordingly.
Yes. I mean, the polarization that we've seen in politics, especially at the state levels, is in direct reaction to the fact that, you know, a good third to a half of the people who show up in the state legislature every session really don't even have a competition when they run for reelection. The powers of incumbency, of course, even if you have a competition, your incumbency is such a huge advantage. And the gerrymandering that happens has contributed to that sort of thing. On top of, you mentioned algorithms recently, but on top of the way that social media kind of bifurcates the electorate between true, you know, people who only hear conservative Republican messages and people who only hear liberal Democratic messages, we're in a situation both socially and politically where it's really hard to get people to talk about looking at government and in terms of like doing what's right for the people and reaching compromise, because you need to reach compromise in order to pass a bill. When you have supermajorities in both houses, there's no need to compromise. Talk to any elected Republican who goes down to the legislature about kind of the quality of the work they do, the impact that they have. A lot of the, even people in leadership have a hard time getting a serious meeting with their counterparts on the other side of the aisle in the state legislature. It's extraordinarily frustrating for the Republicans, understandably. It ought to be frustrating for us too, as people in the state who are represented, we hope, in real ways that represent the whole state. Let's not forget, south of I-80 is either made up of quite conservative Democrats and Republicans, whereas the northern part, especially the northeastern part of this state, is kind of a liberal political ecosystem. Our state is more complicated than you would think when you look at the voting patterns of the state legislature, given these supermajorities.
This is, it's funny you mention that, because not too long ago, George Ryan passed away. And I saw the map that sent George Ryan to Springfield in 1998. And you look at the places where George Ryan did well versus the places where Glenn Beshard, the Democrat, did well. It's a mirror image of what we see today, that Glenn Beshard did very well downstate as a Democrat, which almost seems unheard of in 2025.
Right. And then you look at that, but you then also look at the displays that Bill Daley and Ray LaHood were showing of the maps, of the electoral maps that send people to the state legislature in Springfield. They are just distorted looking. You know, some of these maps run for miles and miles on tiny little 2 or 3 block wide avenues in order to collect the votes they need in order to send Democrats essentially to the legislature. One of the things that they're calling for is a commission that would be made up primarily of unelected people, although they would be appointed by elected representatives. But the idea now in Illinois, as has happened in some other states, is to take the map making out of the hands of the state legislatures, put it into relatively independent commissions, and let them do their work without reference to prior voting patterns, for example, which is one of the proposals that this Fair Maps Illinois group, the Daley LaHood group, is making. Take past voting behavior out of the calculus when you start drawing up these maps, and you'll come up with much more representative government in this state as well as in other states if they were to do it.
David Greising, President and CEO of the Better Government Association, thank you for joining us on At Issue. If you want to hear the program again, you can find it at WBBMNewsRadio.com, the Odyssey app, and now the iHeartRadio app. Join us next week for another edition of At Issue. Until then, I'm Rob Hart, News Radio 105.9 WBBM.